do these lectures, and I will basically introduce this formalism that has been invented by Berkowitz in the years 1999-2000, and in the last 10 years has been developed and has made a lot of progress in achieving its goals. The goals were basically to have a formalism to quantize the superstring in a way that is that keeps manifest all the symmetries, and in particular the target space symmetries. The target space that being the Lorentz and Poincaré, which are manifest in all formulations, but in particular the supersymmetry, target space supersymmetry, which is present in the usual Ramon Neves-Schwarz formulation, but not in a manifest way. And one byproduct of having such a formulation is that in the usual string, when you have a worksheet of high genus and you have fermions on the worksheet that are spin one half objects, and these fermions have are classified by their spin structure. That is, when you take this fermion along a non-contractible cycle, it can be even or odd, and so there are two G. Different spin structures on a genus G surface, and then amplitude is given by a sum over spin structures. Now, typically, string theory amplitudes have nice finiteness properties, but they are only apparent when you after you perform the sum over the spin structures. In this formalism, as you will see, there are no worksheet spinors, and so all the fields are scalars on the worksheet, and so there is no need to perform no sum over spin structures, and so one expects the finiteness properties to be more apparent. And also, so that's the first advantage. And the second is that the Ramond-Ramond fields are treated on the same footing. As the Neves-Schwarz fields. So if you're familiar with the Ramond-Neves-Schwarz quantization, you know that if you want to treat string theory in a Ramond-Ramond background, it creates a lot of problems. And these problems do not show up in a manifestly supersymmetric formulation. So these are the goals. And so how does one do that? The first.
So are we assuming something specific about the background time space in Minkowski or ABS? Or
to start, we start with flat space Minkowski space. Yeah, that has the maximal supersymmetry, and also ABS has maximal supersymmetry, but we'll come to that later. But first, we start from a simpler model, so we reduce the degrees of freedom of the string to just keep the zero modes. Basically, we do the superparticle. It seems like a big reduction, but for most of the things I have to say today, it will not be very different, and it contains all the main problems. So the quantization of the superparticle was achieved by Brink and Schwarz. I forgot in what year this was, but early 80s, I think. Or maybe even late 70s. One starts with this follow, with this action. It's an integral over the world line of It's a very simple action, and there are three fields. E is the field bind, for is the einbind for the basically the metric on the worksheet to make it three parameterization invariant, and then there is P, which is a field, and pi, it's a composite object. Pi is basically the supersymmetric line element. So we are working then in superspace with 10 bosonic coordinates and the Majorana Weyl. It's the Majorana Weyl fermion. So it's a real fermion in of SO91. And now this action has target space supersymmetry as we wanted, where delta is the usual supersymmetry transformation. Delta x is and the other fields are invariant, so this is a manifest because P does not transform, pi, one can easily see that it's manifestly invariant for epsilon, a constant spinor. And there is another symmetry, which is a local symmetry on the worksheet, which is the kappa symmetry. The kappa symmetry has the following form. So it depends on a spinor kappa of opposite chirality than that of theta. And one has the following transformations. And here one needs also a transformation of the einbind. So one can check that the Lagrangian transforms up to a total derivative under this transformation for a generic spinor kappa, which can depend on tau. So this is a local symmetry on the worksheet, so it generates some constraints. And to see what the constraints are, you can compute the conjugate momentum to the spinor. So you get that P, the conjugate momentum for the spinor is the derivative with respect to theta dot, and so we see that it's and this is a constraint because it doesn't contain derivatives of the fields. So we have that this object is P alpha plus 1/2 PM gamma n theta. It's a constraint. So this is and it should be zero. And in quantizing the theory, one has to impose these constraints. So one has to understand the structure of the constraint algebra. So if we want to quantize the theory by asking that P is the conjugate of theta, so that this Poisson bracket or commutator is delta, the one finds the constraint algebra is the Poisson bracket of d alpha d beta is given by I PM gamma m alpha beta. So, and because you see from the equation of motion of the einbind can also be seen as a constraint, you get that p squared is equal to zero, which implies also that this matrix p slash squared is zero, so it's an equipotent matrix, and generically you can put it in a form which is in a block of diagonal form. It's like 0, 0, 0. So what this means is that out of these constraints, there are half which are first class and half which are second class. So there are first class constraints, are the ones of the form p slash d. And you can see that this is, in fact, the generator of the local symmetry. This generates the kappa symmetry. But there are also the second class constraints. Now, normally in textbook treatments of constrained systems, you learn that to quantize the system with second class constraints, you have to impose the Dirac brackets. But the problem here is that if you want to separate the first class from the second class, you have to break Lorentz invariance. And so this defeats the purpose of having a theory with all the symmetries manifest. You are forced to lose some symmetries in the quantization. If you are willing to do it, and for example, the simplest thing to do is to go in the Lightkong gauge, then in the Lightkong gauge, say, we introduce p. P is a null vector, so we can put it along the Lightkong direction p plus, say, which is p zero plus p nine, for example. And then okay, this this matrix has, for example, the form p slash plus is zero. Is the identity matrix in this direction. And then we can fix the kappa symmetry, so it's a gauge symmetry, it needs a gauge fixing. And we can fix it by going to a kind of Lightkong gauge in the fermion direction. So we impose gamma plus theta is equal to zero. It's the gauge fixing. Now what happens in this gauge, so if you decompose this Majorana Weiss spinor as a couple of spinors, of SO8 spinors, which is the residual symmetry group like theta 1, theta 2, then you see that this this gauge fixing implies that theta 2 is equal to 0. Then the gamma matrices in the transverse direction gamma I can be chosen to have a block diagonal form like this. And then you can see that in this gauge, the only term which survives in the action is the one where so the action reduces to x dot mpm plus p plus theta dot gamma minus theta. So because the terms with the gamma I are zero. And then we can do a field redefinition. So theta now has become basically an SO8 spinor. So we can define a new field, say SA, which is canonically normalized. So A now goes from 1 to 8, which is the dimension of a valid spinor of SO8. And they satisfy the algebra SA SB equal delta AB, because the action now becomes x dot p plus s dot plus ep squared. So there are all free fields, and you can quantize. The simplest way is to is to recall that for SO8 there is a triality between the vector representation, the spinor, and the two spinor representation. So there are chiral, anti-chiral, and vector representation, and there are and so this this algebra can be represented on a couple of a vector and a spinor of the different chiralities, such that when S acts on this, this gives a sigma I a dot psi a dot, and when it acts on psi a dot, that's the obvious thing. And then p squared equals zero means that this wave function is satisfies the free field equation, box psi equals zero, and so we recover the spectrum of the theory, which is one vector and one spinor of SO8. So the spectrum eight bosonic plus eight fermionic fields.
So you learn what sigmas are?
The Pauli matrices for SO8. So the basically the, yeah, the matrices that represent SO8 in the on the spinors. So this is the spectrum of 10-dimensional Young-Mills on shell. So there is one 10-dimensional Young-Mills has one vector, a gauge field, and one gaugino, which is a spinor lambda alpha. And if you go on shell, of course, you the gauge invariance implies only the transverse components of A mu are eight components, and the gaugino on shell has half a degrees of freedom, so eight fermionic components. So this gives the multiplet on shell. But that's not what we want. We want to have we have lost the Lorentz invariance and the supersymmetry, the manifest supersymmetry. So we can do. We can do better than that. And there is a covariant description of 10-dimensional Young-Mills in superspace. So this is based on using a superfield, which is like a gauge potential, but in the fermionic direction, which depends on x and theta. And then one imposes a gauge invariance that is given by the spinor derivative of a scalar superfield, where the alpha is d over d theta plus theta gamma m. That satisfies the supersymmetry algebra, d alpha d beta is gamma m alpha beta dm. And one can do also a non-abelian gauge field by if one takes a alpha valued in the adjoint of some gauge group, then the gauge transformation is extended in this way, as usual. And then the non-trivial points are the equations of motion that one imposes on this potential. And this have the following form, which is quite not obvious. Okay, now recall that we are in 10 dimensions, or 9 plus 1 dimensions. We can choose a representation where the gamma matrices are real. And they have the following properties, that one gamma matrix and an anti-symmetrized product of 5 gamma matrices. These are symmetric in the spinor indices. Whereas 3 gamma matrix is anti-symmetric. So this has to be kept in mind because it's important for the. And then from 6 to 10, of course, you can convert using the duality. And the 2 gamma matrix doesn't have the structure because it preserves the chirality of the spinor. So in this notation, it has one index up and one down. So you should think of it as gamma m, alpha beta, alpha gamma, gamma n. So the index up or down says if the spinor is chiral or anti-chiral in 10 dimensions. Now, this equation apart from this term here, this is then a symmetric matrix, so this is a symmetrized derivative, a symmetrized covariant derivative of the spinor potential. So this you can understand as the field strength in superspace. So it's the spinor-spinor component of the super field strength contracted with the gamma 5.
Sorry, just you said this, but can you repeat why? How do I raise the indices for the spin index?
You don't raise them. It's just that the gammas come in a chiral and an anti-chiral version,
right,
like you when you use dotted and
right, okay.
undotted indices in a system. Okay, now, so you can check, first of all, it's a simple exercise that this field strength is in fact gauge invariant under this this transformation. Or gauge is gauge covariant as it should be. So the equation of motion is gauge invariant. So if alpha beta equals zero is preserved by the gauge transformation. And from now on, I will put g equal 0, so I will just look at the abelian case, because otherwise it gets very involved. So for the abelian, Young means. So what I'm going to show now is that from these equations put the theory on shell, namely imposing that the super spinor field strength is zero, you recover the equations of motion on the gauge field. And so because the field strength is a symmetric spinor, it can be it's a symmetric B spinor, it can be decomposed into basis of gamma matrices, and it can only be a one form or a five form. the equation tells you that the five form component is zero. And so as a consequence, you have that this is it's a one form. So it's gamma m. Times some vector, and you can see that the gauge symmetry now on this vector becomes the m lambda. So am transforms as the usual vector potential under under gauge symmetry. Now we can also define another spinor w. In this way, this turns out to be gauge invariant. And finally, from the equations of motion, it also follows that the superderivative of this object is 1/4 gamma mn. Where fmn is the usual gauge field. However, all these objects are still the superfields. Even if f is written as dm an, but is still all has all the theta dependence. Okay, now to analyze the content of this equation, we can first of all, choose a gauge to eliminate some of the gauge degrees of freedom, because the gauge symmetry now is a scalar superfield, so it contains a lot of gauge symmetries, so a lot of components of auxiliary fields to get rid of. And the simplest thing to do, maybe I'll do it here, is to choose a gauge where you say theta alpha A alpha is zero. You can choose lambda to go into this gauge. Then you notice that if I introduce this operator D, which is theta alpha, the superderivative alpha, this actually is the same thing as theta alpha D over D theta alpha, because the other terms will contain a theta gamma m theta, which is vanishes by antisymmetry. This theta theta is an antisymmetric object, and gamma is symmetric. So this operator actually just is a counting operator. It just tells you how many thetas you have in the expansion. So if you decompose a field phi as a phi n, and then with n thetas, then D on phi n is n phi n. Yeah, this is not quite right. I mean, just like this, phi n is an object which contains n thetas. And now we can apply this operator to the equations of motion, and what we get is, as you see, some recursion relation. For example, suppose I consider this object theta gamma m am. Now gamma m am, I know from the equation of motion, is the symmetrized the symmetrized derivative of A, right? Now, from these two terms, you can see that what can you see? Theta, okay, this the first term is theta times D, is this operator. So I get D on A beta. And here I can use the fact that theta alpha A alpha is zero to bring this theta under the derivative. So I get 0 up to the derivative acting on theta, which is just a delta. And so I get again a beta. And now if I expand in the number of thetas, this is 1 plus n, the nth component of beta. And of course, this has n thetas on this side. I have 1 theta, and so I pick up the n minus 1 component of am. And so I get the first relation is that the nth component of a alpha is now you can do a similar story on this equation and this equation, and you get 2 more recursion relations. So you get that AM, the n component of, is 1 over n theta gamma m w n minus 1. And then the other one three relations. Now the first relation tells me that if I have all the components of AM, I reconstruct all the components of A alpha. And from the other two, they couple A, M, and W. And so you can see that to reconstruct the whole superfield, I need two components, which I can choose to be, for example, the first component of AM, so AM at theta equals 0. Let me call it this AM, which is not a superfield now. And then the first component of the spin or field strength, which I can call lambda alpha. And you can see that these are the vector and the gauge now. And then from here on, you can use the recursion relation and completely reconstruct the superfields. So this tells you that I have achieved the covariant description of Young-Mills of super Young-Mills, because I have imposed the covariant field equation, and this implies the correct spectrum. It tells me that only these two fields are physical. All the rest are auxiliary fields, and this satisfies the correct equations of motion. One can check that. And so to see what the fields look like by using the recursion relation, for example, the first few components of A alpha starts at order 1 in theta because of the gauge condition. So the first component is 0, then the first component is the first component contains the vector potential. At the next order we have the gauge Gino. And from here on we have derivatives of these lower term fields. So at order theta cube, we have something proportional to derivative of A. Then at order theta fourth, a derivative of lambda. And then higher and higher derivatives. And it's useful to have also the gauge field. Has this expansion. plus higher orders. Okay, so what we have proved is that the super Young means equations of motion follow from this condition, which is the field strength is equal to zero, which is a bit surprising because it's a first order equation, whereas you normally expect that the equations of motion should be a second order equations. And now this is similar to actually if you just look at four-dimensional normal Young-Mins, but in the self-dual sector. So, you know, if you decompose the, in four dimensions, if you decompose field strength F mu into a self-dual and anti-self-dual part, which you need to be in a Euclidean signature to do that. And then you can impose F plus, for example, the self-dual part to be zero. This gives a well-defined theory, which turns out to be actually an integrable system of equations. The way to see the integrability is to show that these equations are the compatibility condition for a couple of linear equations. So you have two Lux operators, L1 and L2, say, and you want to impose that both these operators are zero, and the compatibility condition is that the commutator of these operators vanishes, and the system is integrable if the equations of motion follow as a consequence of this condition. And in this case, the Lux operators can be written as follows. If I choose S complex coordinates in R4, say Z and W as complex coordinates, and then I can write L1 SDZ is the gauge covariant derivative minus lambda dw bar, and S2 is dw plus lambda dz bar. Then these are linear functions of lambda, which is the spectral parameter. It's a complex number, and for each lambda you have a different set of operators, and when you take the commutator you have a constant term, a linear term, and a quadratic term in lambda. So this gives three equations which can be seen to be exactly this. The self-dual part of a two-form contains three components, so there are three equations in this system. And there is a geometric meaning underlying this, which is the twister construction of Penrose. And in order to understand this construction, one has to understand the global properties of all the objects involved. So the because these self-dual equations are best seen on S4 rather than R4. These are solutions typically that can be extended to S4. And if you do that, then you will find that this lambda is not just a complex number, but it's actually a P1 fiber. So So there is a P1 fiber, a CP1 fiber over S4, such that the total space of this vibration is P3, which is the twister space. And this fiber P1 can be seen in two different ways. Can be seen is the projectization of the spin bundle on S4 for a given chirality, or equivalently also as the sphere bundle of the bundle of self-dual two forms in S4. So as I said, the self-dual three-form is a three-dimensional vector bundle. If you take the bundle of spheres, so you restrict to self-dual forms that have unit norm, if you want, it's a sphere bundle, and this can be seen as this twister bundle. And in this interpretation, a self-dual three-form can also be seen as of fixed norm, can be seen as given a complex structure. So it's also the bundle of almost complex structures. On the base space, which is S4. S4 is not a complex manifold, so it doesn't have complex structures, but and you can see actually already here that this lambda is locally parameterized in a complex deformation because it changes coordinates from Z to W bar, so it's a deformation of the complex structure of the base. Now, what is the relevance of all this for the Pugh spinors? It's simply that Pugh spinors can be seen as the 10-dimensional analog of the twister construction, and we can reproduce all these steps. We already have the self-duality equation is the Super-Young-Mills equation in 10 dimensions, and we can even construct the Lax operators. For the Lax operator, in this case, it's not simply a complex number, the spectral parameter, but it's a spinor. And we have this object where D, again, is the superderivative. And now the compatibility condition is not that it commutes. This is a fermionic operator, so the correct condition to impose is that it should be an nilpotent operator. And if you impose that, L squared equals zero, but L squared is lambda, alpha, lambda, beta, and then this is the anti-commutator. And so we get lambda, gamma m lambda, times dm. And now generically, how can this be zero? Either it's zero because the derivative is zero, but that is a trivial solution, or then it has to be that this factor is zero. And then we are brought to this to require that the spectral parameter has to satisfy this constraint, which says that lambda is a pure spinor. These pure spinors were introduced by Cartan, and they can be defined in every even dimensional space. Basically, again, using this decomposition of these spinors as even as forms, you can have gamma A1 form, and in general there are many components because the symmetry properties depend on the dimensionality, and then the top component is always the dimensionality of the space divided by 2. And then in general, the pure spinor condition is that the bispinor only contains this, this top component. And so in general, you have all these constraints that the lower dimensional part is vanishing. And again, there is a geometric interpretation. This selects a self-dual half top form in the space, which again is in one-to-one correspondence to complex structures. So the so we have the analog of the twister construction, and one can see that of course this constraint is Lorentz invariant, which means that lambdas are a given nonlinear representation of the Lorentz group. What is the dimension of this representation? It's not a free spinor, so it's not going to be one of the canonical dimensions. First of all, we can see that if you multiply lambda by a complex number, I should say that this equation doesn't have any real solutions. So if you want a pure spinor, it has to be complex. So you can take a Weyl spinor in 10 dimensions. So if you multiply by a complex number, this equation doesn't change. So the space of pure spinor has a factor C, which is the scale, if you want. And then it's for the rest, it's a coset space. From the fact that it's up to a scale, this equation selects a self-dual five form in 10 dimensions, which is a complex structure. And once you have selected a complex structure, you can make rotations which don't change the complex structure. These are given by U5. So the stabilizer of the pure spinor is U5, and so this is the coset SO10 mod U5 times the scale. And now if you count the dimensions, you can see that there are this has dimension 11 as complex dimension. And this part, this coset, is the projectization of the space of pure spinors, so it's the analog of the twister bundle. Now, in twister theory, there is also one other nice piece of information, is that how you find solutions of field equations on S4 from data on the twister space. Basically, what you do is you take a field which is holomorphic on P3 of a certain degree in lambda, then you integrate on the fiber, or more exactly on a cycle, a one-dimensional cycle, a contour integral on the fiber. This reduces to a field on the base which satisfies certain equations of motion and has a spin corresponding. So let's say this phi that lives on P3 and is locally can be written as a polynomial in lambda. So it's useful here to not use the projective space, but to write lambda as a Weyl spinor in 4 dimensions. So it has 2 components, and then you can write this as A1, A2, A3, so on, and then phi A1, A2, A3 of X. And then you can integrate this phi on P3 along a cycle, and this will give you a phi A1, AN, X, which will satisfy d slash a dot a1 phi equals 0. So this is a free spin n field. So similarly, in the view spinor, this what you want to write is a field which depends polynomially on the pure spinor variables, and then somehow you are going to integrate over the pure spinor space to get the 10-dimensional fields. That's basically was the achievement of Berkowitz, who understood that this could be applied to the superstring. If you see, if you promote this lax connection to an operator of your theory, then basically you are solving this equation, and this psi will be your field. And you can see that naturally, where can I write? Naturally, you can write a field. It turns out that the interesting fields are just linear in the pure spinor. And so naturally, we have this spinor prepotential, x theta. And then we ask that L on psi is 0. This will this will give again this equation of motion, as we know already. And then the gauge invariance is actually given again by the action of L itself. So delta psi is L psi, which tells us that it's natural actually to interpret L as a BRST operator for the theory that simultaneously generates the equations of motion and the gauge invariance. So this L, we call it Q, which is the BRST charge. And now, how much time do I have for today?
How much time do you need?
Okay, 10 minutes. Yeah.
So just, is there a direct analog of P3 of this bundle over here? I didn't quite see the geometry.
Yeah, the global geometry here, it has not been really understood, yeah. It's not clear, for example, if what compactification of R10 it's useful to take in this case.
Is it clear what the dimension of the fiber would be?
Yeah, the dimension of the fiber is 10.
Sorry. Here you have S4 and a two-dimensional fiber.
Yes.
Here you have
R10.
R10 and a 10-dimensional fiber.
10 complex dimensional fiber, yes. But but then, the analogy then has begun. The problem is then to integrate over this space is not so trivial. Here we could just take the usual integration, and it works. But here, as we will see, you have to specify what does it mean to integrate. It's not the normal integral, or even, well, one has to work to understand how to integrate over the space. So now we have understood how this construction. First I have to say that No, I'll say it later. Okay, we. I want to say how this works basically in the same way for the superstring. So the extension from the superparticle to the superstring doesn't pose many new conceptual problems at the level of understanding the equations of motion. I'm not going to write the Green-Schwarz action, which is the action in superspace, but if you do it and you can derive the constraints of kappa symmetry are a bit different. Now this d alpha is going to be before for the superparticle it was just this. Now for the superstring you have to add an additional term, which is cubic in theta. This object is now a one form on the worksheet, so it has also a worksheet vector index, which most of the time I don't write. I assume that I'm in a conformal gauge and its derivatives are holomorphic or anti-holomorphic, so I'm on the complex plane. The worksheet is a plane. And then Berkowitz just postulated that you can take a free action for the worksheet fields. So let's say S Berkowitz is just dx d bar x plus v d bar theta. So there are left and right movers for all the fields. And then I have to write an action also for the spinors. Left and right movers. And then from the free action, it follows that the fields have canonical OPEs. And from the canonical OPEs, you can work out again that this d alpha, d beta. Now instead of writing the Poisson bracket, we write the OPE of the fields in the conformal field theory is again given by gamma m alpha beta pm divided z minus w, where this pm is the same as before, is dx supersymmetrized. This algebra then closes to the alpha pm gives a gamma m alpha beta d tau. And that's it. And then d theta is 1 over z minus w squared. But anyway, the main point is that this d satisfies the same algebra as the d for the superparticles. And so, again, I can write the Q, which is lambda alpha d alpha. And notice that if d acts on a field which depends only on x and theta, but without derivatives, then the OPE will give the superderivative of alpha. So acting on the zero modes, this d alpha represents the superderivative. But of course, it's more complicated when we have also fields of higher conformal dimension, which can depend on derivatives of x and theta. Basically, this is enough to describe the massless sector of the string. And then by the same arguments as for the superparticle, you can show that this Q, if you take this Q as the RST operator, which means that the physical spectrum of the string is contained in the cohomology of Q. The cohomology of Q is the kernel divided by the image. At Gauss number 1, which means for fields which are I assign a ghost number to lambda, so I interpret it as a ghost. Then at ghost number one, it contains the young meets fields on shell. And this is exactly analog to what happens in the Ramon Schwarz string, where you can write vertex operators that represent the physical fields in the ghost number one cohomology. But you can actually compute the full cohomology of this operator. What is the meaning of this higher dimensional cohomologies? Well, you recall that in the Ramon Schwarz string, you have to, when you compute amplitudes on the sphere, you need three ghost insertions, no, to compensate the ghost number anomaly. So if C is the ghost of the reparametrization, for the BRST charge on the Ramon Schwarz is of the form C times the stress energy tensor, plus higher ghost corrections and then the ghost sector, you need three ghosts, so you can write this combination, which has non-vanishing amplitude on the sphere, and this object can be understood as an element in the degree three cohomology of the BRST operator. So similarly, here we found for the full cohomology of the pure spinors. H star Q is non-vanishing for I going from 0 to 3. So 0, 1, 2, 3. And there is a duality which couples the 0 and the 3 and the 1 with the 2. So in ghost number 1, we found the physical fields, as I said already. And there is a doubling of the cohomology, so they are replicated also at ghost number 2. Physical they can be understood actually as the anti-fields in the sense of the Batalin-Witkowski quantization. If you know what it is, if you don't know, I'm not going to describe because we don't need it. At ghost number 0, the cohomology is trivial. It's just the identity operator. But what it tells us immediately is that also the ghost number 3 cohomology is uniquely generated. So there is a unique element, which is BRST closed, which it turns out that it has this form, is lambda cubed t. It contains 5 thetas. And this is a hint that's the element that we should use to compute the amplitudes. It should be the element that has non-vanishing amplitude. And so, I can just finish by giving the precise prescription for computing the precise form of this generator can be written like this. This amplitude is declared to be non-vanishing, can be set to 1, for example, by normalization. Or another nicer way to express it is to introduce this tensor T alpha beta gamma rho sigma tau, which is here a totally symmetric combination minus some coefficient times totally symmetrized in the spinor indices. So this is totally symmetric, it's totally gamma traceless, and you can normalize it to 1. And then if you have a vertex operator for the string, which is of this form, and want to compute a 3-point amplitude, say, but this could be now could also depend on dx and d theta, and could be massive modes. But the prescription tells you that okay, first you get rid of all the massive modes using the OPs, and you end up with something which is of the form f alpha beta gamma, which depends only on the zero modes now, and three positions on the worksheet. And right, then the amplitude will be given by this tensor. Then with 5 theta derivatives, which can be written as gamma a d over d theta, this has index rho, then gamma b, gamma c, and then a term with 2 derivatives, gamma a, b, c. All these apply to this function. So basically, this this prescription is implicitly telling us how you should do the integral over the pure spinors, but it's not really an integral node. The final thing is this is restricted to 3-point amplitudes. How do you compute higher point amplitudes? Well, again, in analogy with the Ramon Neveu-Schwarz string, you have these are the vertices which have been fixed using reparametrization invariants in the Ramon Neveu-Schwarz string. The other vertices are integrated over the worksheet. So you need a version of the vertex which is an integral of a spin one object, and you can build it using all these currents which are present, d pi and d theta, and it turns out that the integrated vertex it has this form, where for massless fields, these are exactly all the objects I've introduced before in the discussion of the Young-Mills superparticle. And then there is also a current which couples to the field strength. And this current is built from the ghosts as W gamma M and lambda, where W is the conjugate momentum to the pure spinor. And this basically is the generator of Lorentz symmetry in the pure spinor sector. So if I apply NMN to lambda, this transforms as gamma MN lambda in the sense of VOP. And the property of this V is that Q applied to V is the derivative of U, the worksheet derivative of U, where U is this. And using this property, then you can show that if I write an endpoint amplitude as U1, U2, U3, and then I can add any other number of vertices which are integrated, then thanks to this property, you can show that the amplitude is actually independent on which operators I decide to integrate and which ones I decide not to integrate. One can show even more that it is invariant under cyclic permutations, as it has to be. Okay, I think enough for today. It's enough.
Any questions?
So, a very naive question.
Yeah.
A lambda, which is a pure spinner, I mean, can we think of them as like usual anti-commuting spinners? Or
no, they're commuting.
They're commuting. Okay.
Yeah.
Like that. And the dimensionality of lambda is, did you say it was 10 or?
No. No, it's, it depends if you include the scale factor. So the dimension of this space is 11.
Right. I see.
Well, the naive counting gives the right dimension because if lambda is a free spinner, and then you
right,
have this
right.
number of constraints,
yeah, I see.
It's not quite correct because these constraints are not independent. They are reducible, so the counting is, to do it correctly is complicated, but the naive counting turns out to be right.
Okay, let's answer that question.